Good afternoon. I'll call to order the State Government Budget Division for Wednesday, February 7th, 2007. I apologize for the late start. Of course, we had a long floor session, and other members are trying to get their lunch in before they get up here. But we're on a kind of a tight deadline because spilling over is not going to be an option for this committee today or this budget division today because the Rules Committee needs this room as soon as we're done with it. So we do have to finish on time, even though we get started late. And I also believe Ms. Olson from the Campaign and Public Disclosure Board has another commitment that she has to go to fairly soon, so I want to get going here. So the first item we will be reviewing is the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Jean Olson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. With me today is Jeff Siegertson, the Assistant Director at the board. I will give you a brief overview if you want it, although I know you're familiar with ours.
I'm familiar with it. I don't think you need to go into much detail. Maybe we can just talk about the budget issues that are pertaining to you.
That's fine with me. There's very few budget issues. The governor is recommending that the 2% increase in salaries and health care, as everybody else is getting the 2%. The governor is also recommending a 2% increase in our rent budget, which we need because salaries and rent added together is over 90% of our budget, and so we need to be fully funded for that. The governor also recommends the board be part of the SMART provisions, proposals. We're not particularly interested in being a part of that. We can do our own human resource and financial transactions. We have been. We are funded for them, and we're doing them. There was a miscommunication between board staff and Department of Finance staff as to the need for us to be in there. The Department of Finance thought we were going for a budget increase for another staff member, and we were not. So they were looking at this as a way to help us out. We don't need that help, and we understand that it's optional anyway, and we just want to ensure that we're not mandated to be a part of that. The board's activities being political in nature, we would like to keep all of our transactions in-house.
Do you think, has that been communicated to the governor's office? Because presumably he'll be coming out with a supplemental budget, and if you've indicated that, maybe he'll just make those changes when he comes out with his. I don't know if you've communicated that. You've communicated to finance, but
Mr. Chair, we have talked to the Department of Finance, the Department of Administration, and been assured that it's an optional.
Okay.
And we will opt out if that's the case.
Okay.
And then the other issue would be this isn't part of the governor's recommendation, but you may remember that last year the public subsidy contribution from the state of $1.5 million was reduced to $1.25 million. And from that $1.25 million, $130,000 is appropriated each year for the Office of Administrative Hearings for their work on 211B issues for 10A candidates. And the board is suggesting that maybe the legislature would like to fully fund the public subsidy again this year at the 1.5 level.
Well, just looking ahead, the next election cycle will affect the Minnesota House. The constitutional offices are not up. The Senate is not up. So I think the business will be a little bit less, I think, in 2008. But then you got 2010 and 2012, and the Senate is up in both, as is the House. And so you might have a respite for one cycle, but then it hits for the next two. So at some point, I think we have to be aware of what's coming down the road. But, yeah, I think that, we'll see how the numbers work out. So, yeah.
Okay. And other than that, Mr. Chair, that's all that the governor recommends for our budget.
Everybody's asking for the pay raise. You mentioned that. And technology, how are you doing in that area? I mean, I think I've had probably more, working with technology. Your board than I have with other earth groups. But how are we doing? So,
well, Mr. Chair, thanks for asking. As you know, we've done the software, and we did that back in 98 through an appropriation from the legislature. And since that time, we've been able to in-house upgrade it and keep it going. And right now, hardware, we're doing okay with hardware. Am I correct in saying that? And we have 1.5 positions in the office that are really familiar with the technical issues of software and the other IT provisions. And again, because of the work we do and the data we have, we would like to keep all of our IT and all of our software within our agency and not have to go to the broader area that I think the Department of Administration is looking at doing. We would like to stay separate.
I do my own work and figured out most of the things I need to know in the software. Have you had any issues or things from the field out there, people who are less familiar with it and trying to get to understand it?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Mr. Sigurdsson answer
Mr.
that
Sigurdsson,
question.
Mr. Sigurdsson, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Assistant Director of the Campaign Finance Board. We are continuing to update the software, try to add features that are useful to both, as you know, the software is not required, using the electronic transfer is not required. And so we have added a number of features that are trying to be beneficial to the candidates and committees. That has added to the complexity of the software, and we're always trying to balance that to make sure that we have solid software and still add the type of features which attract new users. And we are continuing to also survey and talk to users to find out what we can do to make it more appealing to them. This coming summer, we hope to have enough time to have some outreach programs and contact larger committees and try to get some of the local committees and party units onto the software as well.
Did you have a feel for what the ratio might be between those who use the software and those who do not?
For candidates that filed in 2006, about half of them used the software and reported electronically. It's a much lower percentage for the party units and political committees, although the software is available for them as well. We did have some success with larger committees. Education Minnesota now uses the software. The HRCC is going to use the software starting from this point forward. The Plenty Committee thankfully used the software because the report was very large. So we have had some successes, and we hope to build on that.
Do you have any feeling for why the larger groups are not using it?
I think it's just a matter of introducing the software to them and helping them convert their existing databases into the software, which we now have again on staff. We have a couple of individuals who can help committees migrate data, so it's not a matter of re-entering all of that manually. They can simply migrate their databases, and I think that we'll be able to move some more committees into the software.
Any questions for the members from the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to commend Ms. Olson and the board and the staff because I just, over the years, you know, we've all had dealings with the board over this or that, and as I've gotten feedback, whether it's my campaign or other people's campaigns, they've always had a very positive relationship, very professional, very helpful.
Thank you.
And so we really appreciate your hard work over a long time. I think you've been there, in there as long as me.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, in March I will be celebrating my 25th anniversary with the Ethical Practices Board
longer
and Campaign Finance Board.
Okay. Congratulations.
Anything Thanks. Further? Okay, well, if not, I realize that you've got an appointment to get to, too, so thank you for stopping by.
Thank you.
And we'll be looking at the proposals very soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is the Office of Administrative Hearings. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Raymond R. Krause, the Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. Mr. Chairman, given the time constraints, would you prefer that I dispense with the overview of Office of Administrative Hearings?
Well, let me see. I'm generally familiar with what they do. I don't know Senator Pappas and Senator Roebling, since you're the ones that are here right now. Are you familiar enough with them, or do you need some background on what they do?
I would like some background.
Okay.
I've not been on this
Go
committee
ahead.
For a long time.
Yeah. Thank you. The Office of Administrative Hearings is an independent central panel administrative hearing office of the executive branch, and we were established by the legislature in 1976. Central panel hearing offices are essentially the offices that hold hearings for appeals from state agency decisions that adversely impact citizens or businesses in the state. Office of Administrative Hearings was the fifth created in the country back in the 70s, and now there are 27 states plus the District of Columbia and the cities of New York and Chicago that have offices of administrative hearings. We have essentially two divisions within the Office of Administrative Hearings, the first being the Administrative Law Division, where we essentially are holding the hearings, the contested case hearings for any of those agencies over which we have jurisdiction. And we do those under Chapter 14. And there are currently about 80 state agencies that we hold hearings for. The largest customers of the state agencies by volume of hours spent on their cases are the Public Utilities Commission, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Education, where we do special education hearings. The second piece of the Administrative Law Division work is the rules work, which I know some of you are familiar with. We have we exercise the oversight authority over rulemaking by state agencies to ensure that they follow the legislature's intent and the law from which that rulemaking derives. Third, we conduct hearings under contract for quite a few Minnesota cities and counties. In the past 5 years, our administrative law judges have conducted administrative hearings for 40 different municipalities and counties. We do most of the administrative hearings, for example, for the city of St. Paul, or the city of Minneapolis, and for Hennepin County, as well as a number of smaller jurisdictions outstate. In fiscal year 2006, the division conducted about 560 administrative and rulemaking proceeding hearings. The fourth piece of what we do in this division is something relatively new. Back in 2004, the legislature gave us the jurisdiction to hear cases involving violations of the Fair Campaign Practice Act, and that was previously heard by county attorneys, and they would create a formal proceeding before a grand jury, and it would go forward as a criminal case in district court. We now hear those cases, we received, in 2006, 21 campaign complaint cases, and so far about 50 this fiscal year. And that, as you heard the previous witness, is funded out of the campaign finance budget. And we have, in 2004, we did about... had about $12,000 that we spent on those cases of the $65,000. This year it's closer to $50,000 because it was an on-year election as opposed to an off-year the time before. Fifth part of our jurisdiction, OH rules allow the various agencies to ask us to supply one of our judges as a mediator before a contested case goes to hearing, and that is becoming a larger part of our business. Right now, for example, the Department of Education is shifting a lot of the special ed mediations to our office because they have found that they work well, they're more efficient and less expensive, and we have a fairly good rate of settling those. Finding a mediated settlement, which is cheaper for the school district and less contentious for the parents than going to a hearing on special ed cases. In 2005, the governor issued a reorganization order transferring the functions and powers of the state's Municipal Boundary Adjustment Unit from the Department of Administration to OAH, and that unit is responsible under Chapter 414 for receiving and reviewing all the orderly annexation agreements and petitions for municipal annexation, detachment, incorporation, and consolidation. That is a fairly big piece of business as well. In 2006, the unit issued orders making 378 adjustments to the boundaries of the state's cities, totaling 56,400 and some acres in 62 different counties. So that's a new piece of our work, and we also hear the hearings when those boundary adjustments are not agreed between the parties. With respect to the Administrative Law Division's budget, we operate more or less like a law firm in that we bill on an hourly basis our time as judges and our staff attorneys' time to the agency for whom we are holding the hearing. We are in a revolving fund, so as the business increases and we hold more hearings, we have a larger budget, and we adjust our staffing needs accordingly. When business goes down, for whatever reason, as it does periodically, we have to adjust to that as well. One thing we have done and really emphasized more, I guess I'd say, recently than we have in the past is the use of contract judges in order to prevent, when we get a rush of business, adding permanent staff and then having to lay them off when business subsides. We have now four contract judges on our staff that are used regularly, and when we need them, they're there, and they do a wonderful job, and when we don't need them, there's no cost. We don't have to pay them, and they are in private practice otherwise. So it's a nice way to let off the pressure when we have a high volume of business and we aren't sure that that business is going to be a permanent feature of our budget.
Sarah Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Krause, are they retired judges?
In two cases, we've got two retired judges who are operating as contract judges. The others are not. They are, I'm trying to think now, two of them are former, I think, state attorney general, assistant attorney generals who are in private practice, and the other two are just in private practice that have practices that are not in any way involved with the things we do on a daily basis, so they'd be recused, obviously.
And so, Mr. Chairman, they're allowed to be judges. There isn't an appointment process, or are they considered more like referees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, no, they are judges, and that's in the statute that we have that authority to appoint them on a contract basis. They are temporary and in nature, and they have a two-year appointment.
And they're administrative law judges within the executive branch.
That's correct.
Yeah, they're not part of the judicial branch.
I got it.
All of our judges are in both divisions, part of the executive branch. The only changes that we have in the governor's budget that apply to the administrative law division are essentially involving the municipal boundary adjustment group. There's the bit for salary increase, but also a small increase there for rent, because as many of you know, we are in the process of moving from our commercial space in Minneapolis to the Stassen building here in St. Paul, and we want to be able to consolidate the municipal boundary group with our offices for all sorts of reasons of efficiency, as well as finally giving them a permanent home. And the rent differential between Centennial office building, where they are now, and Stassen requires a small adjustment to their rent to be able to do that. That having been said, because, again, we're on a revolving fund, we have no other increases for the Administrative Law Division that we would be needing to bring to this committee's attention. The other final piece of the Administrative Law Division's work is, as I say, the campaign piece, and that appropriation, as I mentioned, is comes out of the general fund appropriation to the account of the State Elections Campaign Fund. And that, as I mentioned earlier, the $65,000 that we estimated when this legislation went into effect turned out to be pretty accurate. We're at about 50,000 this year in a full year election, and I think we're pretty comfortable that that will cover us in the future on an annual basis, or about 130 over the biennium.
I've got a question or two now. I believe that you're also seeking an additional judge position.
Yes, I'm just getting to the workers' comp division,
sure.
Which is our second division of the two. And in workers' compensation, excuse me, that is pretty much our high-volume business. We have 25 judges in the Office of Administrative Hearings that do nothing but workers' compensation, 23 here in Minneapolis and two in Duluth. We also have judges go outside the metro area to our what we call our hub locations in Walker, Worthington, Owatonna, Mankato, Fergus Falls, and Crookston, again, to make it more convenient for the injured worker to get their hearing closer to home. The two divisions within workers' comp are the settlement division and the hearing division. The hearing division has the bulk of the judges, and they do the evidentiary hearings. And we have always had an understanding with the legislature. It hasn't been in terms of a mandate, but it's been a very clear understanding that we are expected to have those hearings set within 6 months of the time they're certified as ready for hearing. And we are maintaining that 6 month just barely, but we're doing it. Even though we are down from 36 judges to 25, and that is a push, but we're able to do it. Where we have a bit of a problem is in the settlement division, and there are six judges whose job it is to try to get cases to settle. The more cases we get to settle, the fewer we have to worry about in the hearing division, number one, but also it's much less expensive to the system and to the injured workers to have the case settle without going to a full-blown evidentiary hearing. So it's really better for everyone to do it that way. We have seen the number of disputes in the settlement division going up dramatically as opposed to the claim petitions in the hearing division. There are more and more disputes going to the settlement division. It's, as I said, less expensive. It's a faster way to get things done, and so more people want to do that. And with respect to both the settlement conferences, we also do the 239 hearings, which are, excuse me, when the insurance company wishes to stop payment of benefits, or the 106 conferences, which deal with disputed medical bills over $1,500. And those have been backing up, and our decision time has gone on the 239 decisions from 2.7 days to 3.6 days, and from the 106 decisions from 9.8 days to 20.8 days. So you can see, particularly the medical bill cases are really taking more and more time as more and more insurance companies are disputing line by line these very large medical bills, and it takes a great deal of time to do those. We have tried a number of things to deal with this problem. We have shifted hearing judges down to settlement and vice versa. That has not worked well. It's hard to do the scheduling, and it also throws our hearing division timetables off so that we're not meeting the six-month rule. We have tried to double and triple book our settlement judges, and that's what we're doing currently. It gets everybody in, but as you can well imagine, one judge trying to settle three cases simultaneously when settlement conferences are limited to 1 hour, it's pretty hard to get that done, and it's becoming less and less effective, and we're hearing from the practicing bar that our settlement conferences aren't as effective as they'd like them to be in getting those cases dealt with. And that's the reason we're asking for the one extra judge to be able to get those down to at least double booking and hopefully single booking in the settlement conferences so that they can become more effective and we don't put increasing pressure on the hearing division. We have looked at the cost of this, and a full-time judge with salary is about $133,000, which works out to be about 0.01% increase in the total workers' compensation administrative budget. So I think if you look at the bang for the buck, if you will, adding one more judge, is a relatively small cost to keep those settlements moving along at a rate that gets the cases settled, but also in a timely way, both for the injured worker and for the parties that are billing their time and adding cost to the system. So that would be our request for the one judge on the workers' compensation side.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Do you or have you considered using, again, contract judges in this area when you get a backlog and you have to catch up to stay within their time limits?
Judge Cross?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we have. We've looked at that, and that is one of the options that we could deal with. I mean, that I think would help. It's less helpful than the full-time judge for a couple of reasons. One, these things don't flow very evenly, and what we're doing is trying to fill in. We've got a lot of judges who are 50 years and over, and we're having a higher increase of people out for surgeries, out on illness, things like that, and it's the coverage of those vacancies, if you will, when a judge has two cases an hour for an 8-hour day, that's a lot of cases to pick up. It's going to be harder to find a contract judge who's qualified to do workers' comp. First of all, that's a fairly narrow, thank you very much, fairly narrow, discrete area. To find someone who's qualified to do those cases and is available and willing to do it on a part-time basis to fill in on a spot basis like that is we think, going to be pretty challenging to find. If we can find someone like that, that would be great, but I think it's going to be hard to find. It's also, we're going to have to do a lot of training of the individual to get them up to speed for workers' comp. And we just thought it would be better economics if we're going to train somebody up to have them there full-time and get the full benefit of that rather than just on a spot basis. So it is a possibility that might be workable and helpful, but I think there are some drawbacks to it that are also cautions as far as, is that money well spent given the difference in the cost, which is 133 for the full-time versus 117 is what we'd estimate for a contract judge.
Sir Roebling.
And I wasn't inferring that you shouldn't get another full-time judge, but I was just curious that even with that, if your caseload would back up, because I hate to see people having to wait so long, and that's a big concern. And I'm wondering, within the current budget, would you have the flexibility, would you have any money to pay anyone if you found them to help you out if it got pretty severe?
Judge Cross?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we don't at the moment have that. I think we have, and Assistant Chief Johnson can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have the authority to hire a contract judge in the workers' comp division as we do in the administrative law division, but we don't have the budget to do that, either the full-time or the contract. We just don't have that budget.
And we've kept the office quite busy, as was mentioned. You know, we turned over the responsibility of hearing campaign complaints to them, and that's added to the workload. A few years ago, we actually gave them child support issues too, but the Supreme Court didn't take kindly to that. They said that's a judicial branch issue, so they swatted that law down and pulled it back in there. Judge, could you talk about the moving costs? You mentioned it, but you currently have offices downtown Minneapolis. I believe the legislature has already appropriated the money for you to move over. Could you describe what kind of space or digs are over the Stassen building, just some of the rationale, some of the the economics that are going to go into consolidating. I think Senator Pappas is interested because, of course, that's her district area, and she just kind of wants to know what's going on.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. We have currently about 25,000 square feet in a commercial office building in downtown Minneapolis. And if I remember correctly, it's about $26 a square foot. 30 a square foot. And our lease is up, and we thought it made sense to look at other options given the high cost of that space. And in the meantime, in my former life before Chief Judge, I was at the Department of Revenue as Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy, and I knew Revenue was getting some space available because they were moving files, paper files, out because of electronic filings success. And so Department of Administration and we got together and looked at that and found that the space that was being vacated at Revenue was about the same size, a little bit smaller than the space we have now. And at $12 a square foot, $12.50, I think it is. And so huge savings on an annual basis. So Senator Kiskaden took that up on the Senate side last year, and we got about $2 million to refit the space to build out the courtrooms primarily at the Revenue building, the Stassen building. We expect that the bids will come back in on the construction the end of this month, and that construction will start, I think, in March, and that we'll be moving in next summer, early fall. We think the space is going to be a very good space for us. We're going to have all our courtrooms on the first floor and all of our offices on the second floor. Will be a significant upgrade in security over what we have now for our judges. And it's much more customer-friendly than our current space. There's going to be a number of innovations, which I won't go into here because I know you're tight on time, but I think the innovations that we're trying to build into this plan will make it a first-rate, user-friendly court space for both workers' comp and the administrative law division. One of the other things besides the cost differential in rent that I think is worth noting and is something Senator Kiskaden and I were very interested in trying to do is we have worked out arrangements with the Department of Revenue to do cost sharing and shared services. And matter of fact, Dan Ostick from Department of Revenue is here with us today. He's taken over as our chief financial officer, if you will. Since our person had left and we had a vacancy, we are having we're basically piggybacking on the Department of Revenue's staff, quite an excellent staff, if I do say so myself, since I used to be there, but in IT and in business, in HR, the front desk, receptionist area, wherever we can find synergies, we are sharing services there and reducing the cost for both Revenue and for OAH. And that not only is saving some money, but certainly from our perspective at OAH, we're going to have a much higher level of service for no extra cost because we're able to draw on the expertise, the depth of expertise that the Department of Revenue has that we never have as a small agency. We'll never have a 15-person IT department. Just isn't going to happen. And yet we have a one-person IT department now, and we'll be able to draw on the expertise that they have. So that's something that's going to not result in immediate dollar savings in the sense of not being able to cut our budget, but what it will do is prevent future increases from happening in those areas because at least partially, because we have the ability to draw on those resources. So there's some real positives to this move, and we think it'll be better for the people that use our services, much better for them. If we can solve the parking issue, we'll be in marvelous shape.
Could you discuss your technology, what you have? Are you okay with that?
Mr. Chair, yes. We did get an increase 2 years ago in the last biennium for some technology. We have put that money to very good use, and we have gone from a system that was breaking down literally on a daily basis to one that is now, while it may not be state-of-the-art, it's pretty darn close for state agency, and we are in very good shape. Technology-wise, we are moving to a digital recording system because we record our hearings rather than use court reporters, and our existing cassette tape recorders are breaking down, and we're finding it hard to find anyone who will fix them anymore. So we're going to a digital technology for recording our hearings. And with respect to the Workers' Comp Division, it's not directly our technology, but the Department of Labor is starting to work on a project to essentially digitize the process of filing workers' compensation claims. And that will be a tremendous help for us because we have to play off of their system because everything comes to us from the Department of Labor. And right now it's a paper-imaged system, electronically imaged system, which is very outdated and really doesn't meet the needs of today's workers' comp practice, but also has some features in it that are, frankly, troublesome. For example, it all bases off the Social Security number. And we don't think it's, frankly, legal to have the Social Security number be the identifier, the public identifier on workers' comp cases. And this new system that Dolly is putting together would get us off of that Social Security number ID system, which we think would be a very, very wise thing to do. But we have no additional requests for technology. We have done the hardware and software that we need to do to get us where we need to be, and we are now in good shape with the staffing and the maintenance of that through our piggybacking with the Department of Revenue. So we have the budget right now to maintain what we have and keep it current. And we thank this committee particularly for its help in the past in getting us out of that hole that we were in, that technology obsolescence hole that we were in before.
Any other questions on the Office of Administrative Hearings? Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I have to commend you on removing Social Security numbers.
It's going to take some legislation, but we need to do that, yeah.
But I'm from county government, and when you spoke earlier about, bill backs and those kinds of things, we were pretty surprised to get many thousands of dollars of bills for disputes between cities that were within the county where I was a commissioner. And it's like, there's a feeling of, well, what is this all about? You know, so I do have some issues with that. Local governments really they've got a dog in the fight, but only because they're responsible for payment on this, and yet it's not, it's an entity within that county, but they had really nothing to do with the contested election or anything.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to respond? Senator, yes, and that's something we saw as given the rapidity with which the legislation passed, it was an opportunity we missed, and we've tried to fix since then, is educating the counties that this is out there and that you can expect these kinds of bills in a hotly contested case on the campaign practices things. Fortunately, most of them are very small bills, but you're absolutely right, Senator. There are some that are very large, because they are very tough cases that take a long time and are hotly fought with very good attorneys, and it gets expensive, and it's something that the county hasn't planned for, and I understand that. That's the way the legislation was structured when we're dealing with an election that is not a statewide legislation or a legislative election. And I've heard from a number of counties on that, and I have a great deal of sympathy, and we do try as hard as we can to be as efficient as possible to keep those bills down. But some of them do get up there. I do understand that.
Thanks. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Judge. And we'll be reviewing this further soon.
Thank you.
The last item on our agenda is the Amateur Sports Commission, and that is towards the back of your budget books. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Paul Erickson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, and I want to make sure the members realize we have a handout that includes a 5 or 6 pages and then a report book that I want you to referring to.
We have it.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I would like to point out that the Amateur Sports Commission is unique in state government. We have 11 members appointed by the governor, and we have 6 legislative appointees. And on your committee, in fact, here comes Senator Ann Ress, who currently serves on the board of the Amateur Sports Commission, and we were also privileged equally to have Senator Dan Larson when he was a House member. So we have 2 members of your committee who have some additional insight and knowledge of the Amateur Sports Commission. So our governance, have been entrepreneurial and independent. And just to give you a frame of reference, of the some $70 million of capital bonding dollars that the agency has accomplished through the legislative process, probably half were governor's recommendations and the other half were legislative initiatives, so that we play a very unique role of serving both executive and legislative direction. The other thing that's unique about us, before you today, and you can ask yourselves how many state agencies are coming to you with a plan to find an external revenue source to take the agency off the state budget. And we're very proud. Our board is very entrepreneurial. They're very aggressive. And we have a plan before you that will give you an update on our lease program, which is a plan to have the agency removed from the state general fund budget. The second thing,
Mr. Erickson,
yes.
A lot of the members, of course, have not served, at least in the last term,
yes,
on this one. So rather than update, you may have to be quite specific about what the mechanics are, because I'm not sure that they even are familiar with what's in there.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a point to do that. The other thing that I just want to say in the preamble here that's noteworthy, of all the state facilities that are governed by the agencies that come through this division, we believe that we're unique, that the National Sports Center and the Center in Blaine, which the Amateur Sports Commission is the oversight agency, and it's a state asset. It is the only state facility that does not receive a state subsidy. And we're very proud to report to you again, Mr. Chairman, that the National Sports Center in Blaine has, since it's opened its doors in 1990, has never received city, county, or state public subsidy. There are state capital dollars in the facility, but from the operating, we're very proud of that distinction of being able to report to you year after year that the revenues cover the operating costs. And then the final preamble point is that we are an enterprise and that we do not force anyone to use our services. And our plan for self-sufficiency is not raising a fee that a person must pay to buy a fishing license or to be in charitable gambling. All of our customers we have to convince to participate in one of our programs. So with that, let's start with the white sheet first. The first page, the 3 goals since our inception are creating economic impact through amateur sports, meaning that if we can create a facility and a program that has high interest, that somebody will come in from Wisconsin, Massachusetts, Texas, or sometimes Norway and Brazil to participate in an amateur sport experience. And when they're here, they spend money that affects our economy positively. And then secondly, a goal is to create more opportunities for Minnesotans. One of the goals of this program, if we're going to build a pool or a soccer facility or an ice arena, that more Minnesotans get healthy activities. And then a third goal is to be a national leader. Now go to the next page and you'll see the 2 charts. You'll see the record of our results since 1990. The chart with the blue bars is the 12 facilities that have been built by the legislature, that every year now there's just under 5 million people enjoy those facilities. from the speed skating facility in Roseville to the hockey center in St. Cloud to the volleyball center in Rochester. And then the chart below is the economic impact. And this only counts, Mr. Chairman and members, dollars from outside Minnesota. If we have a soccer tournament in Blaine and it brings in $2 million and half the participants were from Rochester and Moorhead and Duluth, those dollars aren't counted. We only count the out-of-state dollars for all of these calculations. Now, an interesting comparison on the next page, you'll see two graphs combined. The green line is our economic impact to the state, and then look at the funding, the state funding of the Amateur Sports Commission, the agency. And if you put an inflation factor on what we were getting in 1990, I think it was $450,000, and the last biennium, the governor's recommendation was $300,000 each year. And then if you look at the line on the very bottom of the chart, how that the state investment in comparison to the return in out-of-state dollars is a pretty favorable comparison. You do need to note, though, that in the last 3 years, we're getting a flatlining effect. The agency once had 10 employees and now has 3 employees. One thing that we do not do as much is create new events. Part of the way that you get economic impact is create an event that will have a draw from out-of-state visitors. So one of the messages today is that since we're an enterprise and that when you cut the Amateur Sports Commission, the state receives less sales tax dollars. And let me just illustrate that if we bring in $70 million from outside Minnesota, that's new money into the state economy. The sales tax on $70 million is over $4 million. The cost for you to fund the agency has been $300,000 a year. And some modest additional funding would actually bring in more money than it costs you to run the agency. But in the recent years, the philosophy in state government is the attention has only been on the cutting side, not on what it might bring into the state. So that's the background on our participation. We used to produce, Mr. Chairman, a book, a report to the legislature when we had a greater budget. I'm giving you a report that is actually 3 or 4 years old, but I think for new members of the committee, it summarizes the 12 plus facilities that were funded by the legislature, and it summarizes all of the grant programs. And I do need to mention to this committee that the agency used to administer 3 different grant programs, the Mighty Ducks Ice Arena Grant Program, Mighty Kicks Soccer Field Grant Program. We had a Mighty Kids After School Sports. All of those programs have been eliminated over the last 4 years. So we do not administer any grant programs. I still get a telephone call every week from some community around Minnesota saying, do you still have a grant program? We have to report. No. Obviously, you know, Mr. Chairman, your committee, you know, would have the option if you chose at some point to resurrect and restart some of those programs, because I can assure you the need is there. But we have been relieved of that responsibility because all of the funding for those programs have been eliminated. Now, so let's go then to the point, Mr. Chairman, you want me to create a little more clarity. In the handout, there's Roman numeral 2, land lease opportunity. This does require some discussion because it's a very unique, and I don't think many agencies and state government have taken this path. The goals first to describe the program, the National Sports Center is almost 700 acres. It's one of the largest amateur sports facilities in the world, if not the largest. And we felt that if we at least, and the number we came up with was 16 acres, that this would achieve 3 goals. We would get an annual lease payment sufficient to cover your cost of running the agency. Remember, the facility is already self-sufficient. It would enhance the National Sports Center as a sports tourism destination. If you go to Disneyland or Disney World now, you know that around those complexes are hotels and restaurants. So it's not just the amusement park. It's places to stay and eat and other activities to do. This would accomplish that. And then we also wanted to achieve some additional infrastructure and parking and capital improvements through this program. Now, we participated with the department administration a year ago, well, the agency did an RFP. We had several big companies. The department administration did an appraisal of the property. And the amenities that Frauen Shoe Companies of Minneapolis is recommending is a major hotel and a water park larger than the water park at the Mall of America. So the largest water park that's over 200,000 square feet, an IMAX and other movie theater complex, a sports and fitness center, sports conditioning business, and restaurants on this 16 acres. Now, maybe we'll just quick refer to the map, which is the next page. So first of all, you can see the scope of the National Sports Center. Now, this is some 700 acres. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's largest soccer complex. We have the world's largest ice arena with 8 sheets under one roof, and the Herb Brooks Center is part of that. And we have probably the largest, children's and family youth golf complex in the country, PGA designed. And now, the area in question. So the 16 acres is in gray. It's part of the North Campus. If you went there today, that's all undeveloped ground. There's no fields there. The second component to get the developer to help do some improvement so that we wouldn't have to come to the legislature to build parking lots for our additional soccer fields, we created a concept of a non-exclusive easement area where we would ask the developer through our negotiations to pay for 1,500 car spaces, which would serve 20-some soccer fields and serve the tenants. But they would have a non-exclusive easement. They would be essentially public parking. The developer, in order to meet their needs of the parking they need for their development, is also acquiring, and they have acquired, additional land adjacent to the state property, and that's in the red dotted area. And so that would comprise the development area. And the non-exclusive easement area would be an attachment to the ground lease, and for benefit of the members, there would be a 90-year lease that this private company would have of this state property. They'd be required to pay the annual lease payment to the Amateur Sports Commission. They would be required to develop the non-exclusive easement area with 1,500 parking spaces and to maintain them with snow removal and so on. And then the lessee is acquiring private land as well. Now, what's the status of this? You all want to know when this is going to happen. We've been negotiating in discussion with Frauen Shoe since the last legislative session. We believe that we're very close. We have an appraisal that the Department of Administration administered as a benefit to establish the value. Since we're still under negotiation, I can tell you that the general parameters we're looking at to get at least the $300,000 a year with an inflation escalator throughout the entire 90 years, so that would grow with the cost of running the agency, there would be all the protections. The Attorney General's office is present at all the discussions to ensure that the state is protected if, during the construction phase, it wouldn't be completed. There would be the protection that it would be removed, or in the out years, if the company didn't perform, the state's rights would be perfected. Now, here's the challenge for us. How do you budget us? Our goal is to get the lease payment, the lease agreement executed in 2007. As soon as it's executed, then the Frauen Shoe companies would be required to start making checks for the $300,000 plus. We originally thought that it would be done before July 1. Now, because of the size of the project, and Frauen Shoe is basically taking the position, look, we can't sign a lease agreement until we have our city approvals. They are in that process now. And so I'm here to report to you, while my instinct is that we'll have an executed agreement sometime in 2007, I can't guarantee you when that'll occur. And so if you go to the last page, what our recommendation would be as an agency is we would write into state law that we would be positioned minimally at the $300,000 a year, which was the last governor's recommendation before the one that you have in front of you. And we would just say that that at the time that the lease becomes effective is that those funds would go, you know, to the agency, Department of Finance, and they would offset. If we don't do that, then we would face the risk. Do you want the agency to go out of business for a period while we were waiting for, you know, the lease payments to take effect? Now, I did want to mention here, I believe that it's in the state's best interest to provide one more position, which would be an event development, because we would get more of an economic return. I'm here to say that, I mean, the agency feels that the minimum amount necessary is the $300K, and we're hoping to get that through the lease payments. But I think that chart would go up a few notches, and you would get more sales tax if we had that one more position as an agency. But that, of course, that's your discretion. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I've given you a brief overview of the agency, a brief discussion on the land lease component, and mentioned where the agency feels that we should be. I want to duly note that there's a difference in the governor's rec and the agency's expectation. And I'll say again, because we have six legislators and gubernatorial appointees, we do feel obligated to tell you what the agency recommendation is.
I do have a question too, Mr. Erickson. Again, this is quite a complex issue that you've suggested, where a private organization would be coming in, leasing land in the National Sports Center, and then that money would be used for National Sports Center purposes. What process is there that there'd be legislative oversight as to the monies that are coming in, how it's being spent? Because I don't think the intent ever was that we would just let the National Sports Center enter into some sort of private arrangement, and then whatever money you make is what you make. I mean, we have some role in here too. So how do we exercise our oversight?
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad you mentioned that. There is no change in the governance. All that, the lease payment is passed through to us, the Department of Finance. You, as a legislature, still have the authority. You could, you know, appropriate it to another agency. We would still come and present our budgets and present our goals and objectives like we have for the last 18 years. It's just that we've identified for state government a funding source. There is no change whatsoever in the governance of the agency and our accountability to the legislature.
I've got another question, and members of the Rules Committee is going to need to be in here by about 2:45, so at some point we'll have to make sure we accommodate them. On page 4 of your the agency overview provided by the governor, at the top it says that the current fiscal year, I guess you get about it's 300 for 2007, it goes to 266, so there's a bit of a drop. Then in 08 it's down to 210, and 09 is 215. It's a little unusual to see numbers going down in the future fiscal years. What's that?
Well, I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to explain this. For the last biennium, the governor recommended 300. There was an initiative by the House of Representatives to retaliate against the agency for successfully completing the lease thing, and they reduced our budget by $90K. We went then back the next year and got a $60-some-thousand restoration. When the Department of Finance then did the calculation for the biennium going forward, they used the 210. And it was a surprise to us, and we think it didn't have the full benefit of all the information available, but that's where that comes from, because we had a governor's rec the last biennium for 300. The House did an initiation to reduce that, and we came back and got a one-time appropriation to supplement it. But for some reason, the Department of Finance representative said they were obligated to use the 07 base as their starting point, and we didn't have a lot of dialogue between the agency and finance. But I want to assure you that the basic need for the agency is $300K a year.
Thank you. Any questions? Sergeant Jarbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand the location of this property. Is that in the middle of the existing commercial development out there?
Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Youngbar, no, it's vacant property now. If you drove by there, there is no buildings on there. It was the Jordan Sod Farm, and it's vacant property.
Mr. Olsey?
On a proposal like this, I don't know the history, so does something like this go out on an RFP to request to develop the project, or how did it work?
Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, the agency made a public announcement in the Construction Digest, and we had three of the biggest developers in the state submit proposals for this opportunity, and they had to compete for the opportunity in a public process.
Okay. Just a quick follow. Did you guys sell the soil that's being pulled out of there, or what's the story with that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, that area we have used the soils for the betterment of the National Sports Center, and we have exported some soils and used the proceeds to make capital improvements at the National Sports Center. That is correct.
Are you going to fill in the hole?
Yes.
Other questions? Okay, well, Mr. Erickson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, next Monday, we're going to hear from the Capital Area Architectural Planning Board, and I think as both Senator Rust and Senator Pappas will tell you, that isn't just the building here. It's quite a bit larger area, and they'll be telling us about that. We're going to hear from Twin Cities Public Television, Minnesota Public Radio, Ampers, which are the small public radio stations, and then Channel 6 for the Twin Cities Regional Cable Broadcasting. We're also, if members are interested, we are trying to arrange a tour of at least public television on a Friday down the road. We'll be in touch with your office to find out if you're available. But they'll be talking about some of their equipment needs. And, you know, those of you who haven't seen what the Almanac couch looks like, you can go over there and look at it. But if you're interested in having a tour of the facilities, we'll arrange that for you. Anything else? If not, as I said, the Rules Committee has to be in here a few minutes, so we do have to get out of here. So, and I don't know what's going to happen on Wednesday. We're trying to talk about the Department of Finance, but we're waiting to hear from them. Meeting adjourned.